For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we come to a conclusion of our study in the book of Daniel. Tonight, what I want to do is we've been spending some time these last couple of weeks on the last of the four main visions that make up the book of Daniel, and certainly the second half of Daniel from chapter 7 through chapter 12. And in this last vision, which is just so extraordinary in its proportion, where Daniel is given insight and understanding about the unfolding of all of human history and beyond human history, as we talked about last time, into the very eternal state that we stand before God. And so it's just cosmic in its dimensions. And yet there has been a kind of a story that's been in the background throughout the book of Daniel. And I want to bring it into the foreground here tonight. The story about the unseen world, the dynamic behind history, the personalities and such that make up a much more populated universe than our eyes have access to. And so, well, for obvious reasons, we'll see that Daniel chapter 10, verses 2 to 21, kind of bring this thing out. And let's just take a look at it. He says, in those days, and he's talking here specifically about the reign of Cyrus, the Persian emperor. He says, I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks. On the 24th day of the first month, that's April 24th, while I was by the bank of the great river Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked. And behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold. His body was like beryl. His face flashed like lightning. His eyes like the gleam of polished bronze. And his voice roared like a vast crowd of people. And he said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words I'm about to tell you and stand up, for I have been sent to you. And when he spoke these words to me, I stood up trembling. And then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come to respond to them. But the spirit prince of the kingdom of Persia was opposing me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the archangels, came to help me, for I had been left there with the spirit prince of Persia. And now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. But now, he says, I will return to fight against the spirit prince of Persia. So I'm going forth, and behold, the spirit prince of Greece is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writings, there is no one standing with me against these forces except Michael, your spirit prince. Whew. Weird. This is one of the weird passages in the Bible for a lot of different reasons. And I want us to just kind of take note of the language that's being used here. He's talking about fighting spirit princes that are associated with Greece and with Persia. There seems to be good guys and bad guys in this strange cosmic kind of drama that's being put out here. I think to the modern reader, this is really odd. And I thought it would be good for us just to take a step back, because as strange as this language is to us and the images that it evokes, nonetheless, the idea of a actually existing spiritual realm and the dynamics that happen in that spiritual realm are extremely important to the unfolding of the biblical story, and that are really present from the very beginning in the early chapters of the book of Genesis all the way to the end of the book of Revelation. So we're talking about something that is not a small theme in the Bible. It's not the center theme, but it's an important one. And it's important for us here tonight to draw out what's going on here. I want to talk about this just from the standpoint of many of you tonight who are here and This is not something that you've really thought through a whole lot from the biblical perspective. Maybe you've got some ideas about the spiritual realm that you've picked up from maybe from your education, from the culture that we live in. But the one thing that we can say for sure is that no one is neutral on this subject. And there are beliefs that span the whole history of humanity and that are global in dimensions regarding the whole how do we view the spiritual world. One of the real anomalies historically, actually, is the outlook that many of us come to this in the modern Western world, which is with the kind of skepticism that says, spiritual, no such thing. Because in our culture, more or less the things that we take for real, the things that we say that we can know about, are things that we can engage with our five senses. If I can see it, if I can hear it, if I can smell it, taste it, or touch it, well, that's what's real. As we say, seeing's believing, right? And so in our culture, we have grown up with the thinking. For a lot of people, it's a very conscious thought. For some of us, it's just sort of a subtle thing that we don't even maybe take note of the fact that we think this way. But nonetheless, it is true that there is things that we can know, the things that come to us through our senses, and then things that more or less fit into the category of the superstitious or the strange or the bizarre or the things that make up faith. And that kind of dichotomy is really a part of how Western world thinks about these things, which is what I grew up with in my background and in my studies as a young man at Ohio State, low those centuries ago, it seems like now. I became a philosophy major, and I met with my advisor for the first time as a sophomore, and he asked me, what are you interested in? And I said, I'm interested in philosophical aspects of God, you know, philosophy of religion. To which he smirked and said, huh, we don't find many of you people around here these days. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah. It's like, you know, because there are things that you can know, and then there's just things that you want to believe. And for him, and it was just one of those aha moments for me, because it was like, of course, you've just put into words the attitude that just pervades our society. But for the rest of the world, this kind of skepticism and cynicism about the spiritual world is very strange indeed. And most of the world looking on says, gosh, you know, okay, skepticism about the unseen. That's okay, I kind of get that. But aren't you really going so far that if you are skeptical about anything that doesn't appeal to your senses, that you can see and touch, things that you can hear and feel, that anything that even matters is now taken off the table and relegated to the place of just superstition or opinion or things that you can't know about. Things like, you know, to say that something is good or that a certain act is just. Those aren't things that appeal to the senses, are they? Those are evaluations. Those are judgments that emerge out of our conscience. But in our culture, in our world today, what we say is that everything that you are is just reducible to biomass. And so what am I? I'm a very sophisticated network of neural impulses, of biological functions, and that's who I am. That's what I am. And so language about human dignity and value, what is love? In our culture, it's just a chemical reaction. That feeling that mothers have for their children. In our culture, what does that mean? It means, well, you've got a certain instinct, a bonding instinct. That's really all it is. Love, that's just a term that we put on what can be completely explained biologically. And so that's the undercurrent of our culture. To the rest of the world looking on, they say, how weird is that? None of the things that really matter to life have any meaning to you. And that is the way it is in our culture. But on the other hand, then there's the other polarity, which is much of the rest of the world where spiritual phenomena more or less occupy a center point, a center stage in the way people look at the world. And so we've talked about spirit guides as being an important part of animistic religion that dominates much of the world. We talk about spirits relating to places and things, objects and locations. We speak of guardian angels. We think of, especially in the Far East, ancestors and their ghosts that inhabit the world. And there are whole religious systems and whole rituals. And in many places, the whole pattern of life is oriented around these things, and about which the Bible says virtually nothing. And so what I would like to do tonight is take this step back a little bit and ask ourselves this question about the spiritual world, and what does the Bible say about it, and why does it matter? And why does it matter? So let's begin with the question, what are angels? Because what we have in Daniel chapter 10 is, in fact, a description of the angelic world. And the description of these spirit princes, as the New Living Translation puts it, are of dazzling and powerful beings. This image that Daniel is confronted by is just way bigger than life, that is so awesome in its presence that he falls to the ground, unwilling even to lift his head up at various points. And this is just this magnificent, majestic being in his presence that just dwarfs all of the other created beings Daniel has ever seen. And these are persons without physical bodies. They are persons. Angels are personal beings just like you and I are personal. That is to say, they have will. They're moral beings. They have a conscience. They operate on terms of good and bad, right and wrong, things like that. They have intellect. They're intelligent beings. And yet they don't, and while they have some sort of localized physical manifestation, they don't have physical bodies. They have something else, which is, I don't know. But they can be seen, and yet they're not physical like we are. They have some access to human beings, as this passage makes evident. That the word angel actually means messenger. They're called angels because that's their primary function. And so these angels are giving messages in these visions to Daniel. And they do throughout the scripture, actually. These angels appear with a message. They seem to be localized to territories in some cases, and certainly in this case. We talk about the spirit prince of Persia, the spirit prince of Greece, and of Michael, he says, the archangel. Who is your spirit prince, he says. And so there seems to be some sort of involvement then of these spiritual beings and association of them with humankind and the nations. And that they carry with them a range of influence. Some are malevolent influences, some are benevolent influences. Some of them are almost completely unnoticeable. Others of them are overwhelming in their effect. And I want to kind of spin that last point out here in just a couple of minutes. But as is evident from this passage, where he says right there in verse 20, "But now I must return and fight against the spirit prince of Persia," that there is a conflict going on in reality behind the physical universe, in reality that is behind history itself. And let's just break into a little background on that. This debate, this conflict exists between angels that align themselves with God and what we call fallen angels, angels that have gone awry in some way and who are now standing in opposition to God himself. We wonder what went wrong. Why is the conflict? And interesting, Daniel's younger contemporary, the prophet Ezekiel, also living in captivity, has a description of just exactly what went wrong. In Ezekiel 28, he says, now here's God, and he's speaking now to the spirit prince of Tyre, who actually ends up being this powerful demonic being who is really none other than the arch nemesis of God himself, his adversary, the devil, Satan. He says, you were internally filled with violence. Your heart, he says, was lifted up with pride because of all your beauty. Your wisdom was corrupted by love of your own splendor, and you defiled your habitation by your many sins and deceit. What happened was, and as Ezekiel describes this incredibly beautiful being, this being that can only be described in the terms of the most precious gems and minerals that are found upon the earth. And just a weird description. You just read the passage yourself in Ezekiel 28. But he comes to this place where he says, you were so beautiful and so powerful that at a point your heart became aware of your magnificence, and that translated itself at a certain point. You made a decision to exercise your pride, to exercise self-will, to engage life on not God's term as a created being, but on your terms as a being of great splendor and great beauty. And so he says you became corrupted at that point. Now for the first time, two wills have emerged in the universe. The will of God, the good and perfect will of God, and this other kind of will that is born out of pride that says, I answer to no one but me. I'm my own authority. I choose to live life on my terms. And that's really what's being described here, and also in a similar passage in the book of Isaiah chapter 14. And so as a consequence, we are told that the unseen, the spiritual world itself became divided into those beings that remain subordinated to God, loyal to him, believing in his basic goodness, and those who had become suspicious of him and who had opposed their will to him. A spiritually divided universe. And it is within the framework of that division, then, that the biblical creation account is set. And there is a contention after God creates the heavens and the earth, and he creates humanity in his image and places humanity in the garden. He's placing him also at a place that presumes that the universe is already spiritually at war, that humanity ourselves, as free-choosing beings, as persons, are at a place that we can choose what voice we choose to listen to. And so, you know the story. This is Genesis chapter 3, and the serpent slithers his way to Eve and says you ought to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that God said don't do that because on the day you do it, you shall surely die. And this spiritual adversary says to the woman, you shall surely not die. You will not die. God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be open. You will be like God. And so it says the woman was convinced. She saw that the tree was beautiful, its fruit looked delicious, and she wanted the wisdom it could give her. And so, in a nutshell, this is it. This is the deal. This is the problem in the universe. From the Bible's point of view, we can put it in three ways. It is a contention over, is God good? God said, here's this tree. It exists as an opportunity for you to either obey me or to disobey me. It's a pretty awesome looking tree. But the question is God's prohibition against eating from that, is that to preserve and to protect the innocence of this human creation, or is it, in fact, God depriving these people of something that would be delicious? and that would give them something that God was withholding from them. And so it really comes down to this question, is God's leadership in human life for our benefit? Is God really motivated by our good? And this becomes then a very serious contention. And a second one that is with it. Namely, what does it mean to be free? Adam and Eve, from God's point of view, living under his protection, living under his provision, were free. They were free to experience him. They were free to experience one another. They were free to do whatever in this idyllic place. Free. And yet, there's a different kind of freedom that enters into the vocabulary here. Not freedom to experience God, to draw life from him, to experience his abundance, to explore his creativity, to live in his world. There's another kind of freedom, and that's the freedom that says, I want life on my terms, my way. That's a different kind of freedom, isn't it? That's a freedom for self. That's a freedom for me. That says, my rights are what matters. My rights to live my life my way. That's all that really matters. And so there is that opportunity that God created for beings, if that's the way they want to go, they're free to make that decision. They're not free, of course, with respect to the consequence. Right? Because in taking that decision and in embracing that kind of freedom to go my own way, to be the master of my own destiny and so forth, we begin to realize, hey, there are 6 billion other people who have made that same choice. And how's that working out for us? Now we have 6 billion narcissistic individuals who are living for self, who are defining what's right for them and living life on their terms. And if that means stepping all over you or whatever, taking things that belong to you, so much different, you know. It was wonderful hearing from our children here this afternoon, wasn't it? It's beautiful. What we have sheltered you from is the reality that when you put a bunch of children together, little ones in particular, in a room together, they will beat each other. They will steal from each other. They will spit, kick, bite each other. They will claw each other. They will do whatever they want that entertains them or gets them what they want. And that's why we have to domesticate them. And as we age, well, we become more sophisticated, to be sure. But does our essential nature change? I think history says no. See? And so humankind has emerged and has sided with this contention against God. Is God good? I think God's depriving me of something that I could better get on my own. I think I don't want the freedom to draw my life from God and to experience the abundance of his love for me and his provision for me. I want to live life on my terms. That's what freedom is. We've gone that way. Who has the right to rule? Oh, man. Oh, man. Today, that's hard for us to deal with as 21st century Americans, used to self-governance, used to being the individual. We think of ourselves as answering to no one. The reality is that we are created beings. The reality is that we are created beings. The reality is that we will answer to authority above ourselves because we are created beings. We answer to our Creator. Who has the right to rule humanity? That's a contention. The contention. One side says, look, humanity has sided with the opposition. The other side says, but it's God's right to rule. He is the Creator. And so you end up then with these battles apparently existing among angelic beings. I don't know what that conflict was that lasted for 20 days between these angelic beings, but it had to have been an argument over the rightness of what God was revealing. And so you've got, you know, a big, powerful, magnificent being frightening in its dimensions, saying, "This is my world, bleh! You know, I'm the Prince of Persia." And the other saying, "This is God's world. You have no right here." "Oh yeah, says who?" You know, and so you got that kind of thing going on, and they're fighting it out over these most very basic things. It would be a strange, I don't know, it'd be a weird place to be. But that's what's going on. And so the Bible story then is God at work defeating the usurper and freeing spiritual prisoners from their captivity to this new kind of freedom that they have embraced, which is actually deep bondage. That is essentially the message of the Bible. There is a fracturing of the wills that govern the universe. There are catastrophic and cosmic implications to this divided universe that we live in, with humanity very much at the center stage of what is of the unfolding of this drama. And the message of the Bible is that this rebellion will come to an end, and that God will establish his rule on the earth, even with, yes, his own rebels, because he is going to purchase their freedom from their own spiritual captivity. And that is the message of the scripture from the very beginning to the very end, and it centers on the person and on the work of Jesus Christ on his cross. It's in the cross that God accepts by himself voluntarily the due consequence of our own error and our own rebellion against God. And so that in responding in trust for what God has done through Christ on the cross, the power of the revolt is broken. That it is possible for sinful people far from God, like you and me, to draw near to God with real confidence, to experience his goodness, to experience the freedom that he really has for us, and to experience the inheritance about which we spoke last week. And that's a really a beautiful and awesome reality. The whole Bible is the drama of how God brings that about and what does that look like. Let's just press this a little bit further. I want us to understand here tonight, I don't know why we chose this topic on this day. It doesn't seem like a Mother's Day topic, but so it is. You have an enemy. Me? But I'm such a nice guy. I'm a lover, not a fighter. You have an enemy. Yeah. We all have an enemy, a spiritual enemy. There is no place of neutrality in this cosmos, in this universe. We are free to choose what side we align ourselves with, but there is no place of neutrality. You have an enemy, and Peter puts it like this. He says, "Be sober and be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour." So you got a lean, mean, hungry enemy. And he's smelling his prey. And guess what? It's you. That's kind of what he's saying here. There's a battle going on in the unseen. And it doesn't help as modern Western thinkers to stick our head in the sand like an ostrich and pretend that there is no spiritual realm out there, that only things that matter are the things that are concrete and physical and material and right in my face. And there are implications for that, but that's for another day. Let's talk in specific terms then about how this war is waged. And first, I want to talk about just two kind of general categories here tonight. We can't cover the whole topic, but I think that there are a couple things that matter a lot. The first has to do with the allure of power. How is it that our spiritual opposition seeks to dominate the lives of the countless billions of people who stand outside of a relationship with God? There is real spiritual power that exists in this world and is present in every culture, and there is a power that is connected that seeks to draw people in ways that we don't often understand. Second, lies and deception. That's how the spiritual world is in conflict, and that's how we're engaged with it ourselves. In a couple ways. First, in terms of God problems, harsh and naive views of God. And it's very easy to begin to kind of cultivate in your heart the idea that when I'm guilty, when I've done something wrong, there is that voice that comes to me and says, yeah, you did, and God is not pleased with you. And then we begin to just sort of extrapolate about a harsh God who cannot be pleased and this type of thing. And some of us really struggle with that kind of relationship with God. Even as Christians, we can struggle in this way significantly. Others of us are kind of naive in our views of God. And it doesn't really matter what I do because, you know, whatever, God's the forgetful grandpa in the cosmic, you know, nursing home or whatever, and he's not going to take anything seriously that I do anyhow. Nothing really matters at all. And both of these things are going to get us into significant problems spiritually with God. Here's the message that I get. It's just real simple. It is, you suck. And you, because what you do doesn't matter, because you screwed up here and you screwed up there and there and then in the other place. And all of these things, they just come at you and they challenge the basis, the foundation upon which we stand with God. They challenge the idea of grace. That's one thing that God's opposition cannot understand. How God, though holy and morally perfect, can allow really violently screwed up people like you and me in his presence. And he that is a category that is not understood by our spiritual opposition. And so to get us off of grace is absolutely priority one. For your enemy in your life wants you to walk away from grace 100% of the time. A second thing is that in our culture and all of us, because we live in this milieu, we breathe the air, is that we are presented with a myriad of alternatives to God, a myriad of alternatives, a world of distraction. As John says in 1 John 3, says, everything that's in the world is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life. He says, these things are not from God. And it's just like, you know, in an affluent culture like our own, we can just consume ourselves with success and with possessions and with all of these things that just make the whole concrete awareness of God meaningless to us, abstract at best, very distant indeed. And when we have been drawn into that and just basically neutralized, then our enemy has won, because we no longer stand out. We have nothing to offer the culture because we're no different than the culture in our affections and what we are thinking about and so forth like that. And so that's a problem. Now let's move in a positive direction. What should we do? A couple things. First, there are two basic instructions that I want us to think about here briefly. The first is just to be alert. Remember, we cited 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, be sober and be on the alert. And that's important because you can very easily be played. No one likes to be played, you know, manipulated, conned. You know, we feel like, We just don't want to be there because that's embarrassing and all that kind of stuff. Well, you know, you have a being who has a bad will for your life, and he's a lot smarter than you, and it's easy to get played. And you get played by the devil when you have unresolved bitternesses. Don't let the sun go down on your anger, he says. Don't give the devil his opportunity. And yes, indeed, you know, so someone has offended me. They've done me wrong. Maybe they didn't even really do me wrong, but my pride was hurt somehow. And so the offense wasn't real, but I really took offense. And now days have elapsed, and I can't shake it. And I'm beginning to reinterpret history that tells me that everything I know about this person has led to this diagnosis, that they cannot be trusted, that they are really out to get me, that they are not good, that they are just, you know, whatever. You know what bitterness is about, right? Well, maybe you don't. Yes, you do. Come on. And bitterness is just something that, when unresolved, just grins. You begin to be cynical about not just that person, but other people who remind them you of them. And you begin to extrapolate out from there. And pretty soon, you've got bitterness as a way of life, and you are in bondage at that point. And a lot of people, and many of us here tonight, live in bondage, or a step or two away from real bondage, because we cannot apply grace in our relationships with other people. We can't say, look, real or imagined, I feel hurt by you, but it would be the height of hypocrisy for me not to extend the grace and mercy that God has shown me to you. So I forgive you. I'm not holding this over your head. I'm ready to move on. Well, another thing that would be important here would be the unchecked thought life, where we just kind of let things go. And the unexamined life. A lot of us are not very reflective people. We just kind of are. We do, and we experience, and we love stimulation, and we're out there doing our thing. And we just don't even really think about the fact that what we're about and what we're thinking about, what we're allowing to occupy our minds, is just not the things that God views as a priority at all. And we find that we're really far from him. Really far from him. And in that sense, it's just like you wake up at a point and you realize, man, I don't know God. He just seems so distant from me, such an abstraction. I don't even know what's going on with him anymore. And that becomes a problem. Unchallenged values and priorities in our lives. You know, what are you about? How have you defined success? What is driving you? And, you know, most of us find that the things that drive us, the things that really motivate us, are things that the culture values. They're things that are just like right out there. And we don't examine them. And we don't say to ourselves, oh, really? And make some decisions then about what do we want to drive our passions and to assess our lives, things like this. And as a result then, again, we just begin to be like everybody else in the culture. We become completely neutralized. So there is the alertness issue. Then there is also here, and I think very importantly to end on this, there is the issue of being confident. And to not worry that there's a demon behind every bush who's going to, you know, devour you for dinner tonight or whatever. That's not the way the Bible describes it. The dangers are real, but the adversary is weak compared to our advocate, who is God. John says in 1 John 4:4, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And so we've got access to greater power than anything that drives this world and its spiritual underpinnings. And so that means a few things. It means three. One, it means that God calls us to a truth focus, not to operate out of fear, but to realize that the battles that we fight are battles over truth, like we've described here. and that it is important for us to immerse our hearts and our minds with the truth. Paul puts it like this, 2 Corinthians 10, verse 5. He says, we're destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God and are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And some of us are just frankly really bad stewards of our thought life. We don't examine what we think, and so we just, because it's unexamined, it becomes a part of how we behave, it becomes a part of what motivates us and so forth. And what God is saying to us is, man, no, you take how you think about stuff, how you think about the key relationships in your life, how you think about what's important to accomplish in life, things like that. Take that up, the things that you are hearing from the culture around you. You take these things and subordinate them to what God has already revealed in His Word. We used to talk around here years ago about thinking Christianly, which is a dorky word, but it carries with it a very important idea, and which is that God calls us to really take our professions, our careers, our families, all that we have. And we know that there's a certain take that the culture around us has on those things. And it's a mix. Some of it's good and noble and healthy, and a lot of it is not. And to think Christianly is to inject biblical truth into those things that have our ear, so that we are assessing and we are evaluating those things that bear real influence on our lives. I think as we get older, and I speak first of myself, but I indict you in this as well, I think we get lazy. I think a lot of us have just taken the values that are out there, the way things are, and we just say, that is the way it is. When from the biblical perspective, it's all smoke and mirrors. It's rooted in assumptions about what will make you happy. It's rooted in assumptions about who are you and why do you matter. Things that are not from God. And to be vital spiritually is to think Christianly about our world, about our life, about the things that are always vying for our loyalty, always vying for our hearts. Second, there is a love focus that's important in terms of our ability to be confident in the spiritual realm. Jesus puts it like this. This is his last prayer for his disciples before he goes to the cross. He says, and he's praying to the Father, and he says, I don't ask that you take them out of the world. No, they're going to stay right in on the front lines of this battle. He says, but I do ask to keep them from the evil one. And he says, as you sent me into the world, I've sent them into the world. How did God send his son into the world? How did he do that? By setting aside his rights as God to become a servant among rebels and to offer up his life for their freedom. That's love. Love means that God has moved toward us even though we don't deserve it, to give us something that we could never get on our own. That's the love of God. And he's saying that's how my people are to be sent into the world, to be the stewards of this great message, this incredible truth. And it is as we are obedient to that call and we're just able to share on a personal level the goodness of God toward us, the things that we have known to be true from the Word of God, we're going to engage opposition from spiritual persons who don't want that message to get out. And so Jesus is saying here, he's praying for his people that God would protect them. He's going to keep them in the world to live this way. But he prays for their protection. We can be confident because he's prayed for us. And third and lastly, there is an honesty focus about this whole thing. That our enemy is a liar and the father of lies, Jesus says. And that in the face of honesty and truth, our opposition cannot endure. And so Paul says to the Ephesians, this is Ephesians 4, he says, speak the truth to each other. It means all of us. We all have that role to play. He says, for we are members of one another. We're a community, but more than a community, we're a body. And what happens with one part of the body affects the whole. And so we are members of one another. My future is tied to yours and yours to mine. And he says, don't let the sun go down on your anger and don't give the devil his opportunity. And it is as we stand under the grace of God in our relationships, knowing that as sinful people, we will fail. We will fail. But that's not the end of the story and that's not the end of the relationship. We have a power to grant real forgiveness to people and then therefore to have reconciliation because we've experienced that same grace from God. And we can speak the truth to one another for each other's good. For each other's good. Because lies bind. Believing lies binds people up. Believing lies destroys people. A lot of people have been, their whole way of viewing the world has been devastated by lies that people have told them, things that are not from God, things that they can't forget, things that that just drive them about who, you know, why do you matter? Why do you think you're significant? What are you really worth? These kinds of things, and we all struggle in various ways with these things. I remember 40 years ago, 39 years ago, that's how closely I remember it, the dominant male of my life squaring off with me and said, you are stupid. You are really stupid. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, you must be right. I'm stupid. And I can tell you that over the course of decades, even with evidence to the contrary, that narrative is still there. And so there's compensation for that. There's proving yourself. There's all that kind of stuff that's there. It's there in my life. It's there in your life. When we accept lies and they are ingrained into our psyche, it is to our detriment. We are to speak the truth in love to one another. And that liberates us from the spiritually binding power of lies. And the great tragedy of the American church and the great danger for your home church is our refusal to speak the truth in love to one another. And therefore, we're walking around in chains just like the brother and sister sitting next to us. And that's something that we can change, and we can change it here tonight, and we can decide, I'm going to stand on what's true. And I'm going to be an agent of real spiritual liberation in the lives of the people around me. And that is a measure of our integrity as men and women of God.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.